Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. I'm your host, Cara Nyhus, with co-host Bing Gong. On today's show, we ask, after the Trump inauguration, now what? We are pleased to bring you two great guests to debate strategy for collective responses in the Trump era. There's a lot of debate about strategy and how to respond, and obviously responses are already underway. There's also a lot of non-debate, that is, we have political habits and sometimes we just do what we always do without necessarily having a worked out analysis and strategy. Or we have an analysis and strategy, but it may be based on conditions or assumptions that no longer apply. Either way, sometimes we do things that don't work just because they feel good to us. So now on this show, we're going to be hosting our guests to check in on their strategic thinking about where to go with progressive movements.
And our guests today are in the studio. We have Norman Solomon, longtime media critic, commentator, and anti-war activist. Solomon is a longtime associate of the Media Watch group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. In 1997, he founded the Institute for Public Accuracy, which works to provide alternative sources for journalists, and served as its executive director until 2010. Norman's weekly column, Media Beat, was in national syndication from 1992 to 2009. More recently, in 2012, he was a congressional candidate in California's 2nd Congressional District. He attended the 2016 Democratic National Convention as a Bernie Sanders delegate, and he resides in Inverness Park. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Norman Solomon.
Hey, thank you. Thank you.
And on the phone in San Francisco, we're joined by famed civil rights attorney Dennis Cunningham. Dennis has taken on the FBI about COINTELPRO. He sued the Chicago Police Department for the murder or assassination of Black Panther Fred Hampton, and he's defended the prisoners of Attica who were beaten and tortured during the 1971 prison riot, and then I would add, blamed for it. He also cleared the name of nonviolent environmental activist Judy Berry, who, along with Daryl Cherney, was labeled a terrorist when a bomb exploded underneath the driver's seat of their own car. Dennis's legal team won a settlement against the FBI, who distorted evidence and tried to give the impression that it was their bomb. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Dennis Cunningham.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
All right. Well, before we get into the longer-term strategy, let's just talk a bit about what happened this weekend. And at the end of the show, listeners, we will be running down some upcoming events and newly forming groups and other opportunities to plug in, so get your pencils and your smartphones ready. Okay, first let's start with this whirlwind weekend. So much has happened in just 3 days. First, the inauguration. Let's give each of our guests a minute to remark on whatever you think was most important, who was or wasn't present, Trump's speech, and what this presidency represents. What's most important to you about the inauguration? Let's start with you, Norman.
The response from people, well over a million, by some counts closer to 2 million people around the United States, let alone around the world, who said, we're not going to take this. We have no interest, willingness to accept the legitimacy of this regime that's come in. We're going to mobilize in a lot of different ways. One of the things that I found most wonderful, personally, being at the demonstration in Oakland on Saturday, was that it was so creative and spontaneous. There was not marching orders. There were people who brought their own signs, their own energy, their own creativity. That's what it's going to take. It's going to have to be a 24/7, 365, as ideally always has been, to push back against corporate power, against militarism, against the racism, and a lot of the other injustices that are just so woven into the structure and institutions of so much of our society, the gender bias, the class bias, the racism, we know the homophobia that all of that and more needs to be challenged directly. And, of course, the twin perils for the future of humanity, and that is climate change and the specter of nuclear destruction.
Thank you for that. Dennis, how about you? What strikes you most about the inauguration?
Well, I kind of agree. The thing that sticks out is the size and the fervor, or at least the earnestness of the response, and the sense that further developed than in anything we've really seen, at least for quite a while. And so it poses for us the question: if it's just a beginning of some level of activism and resistance and hard work that's going to transcend anything we've seen and be equal to, you know, what the people are up against here, or whether, you know, it will be a high point and then things will slide back down.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem likely that that'll happen, but, you know, we've seen it before.
And I'll add to that that responses on Inauguration Day were somewhat different from the protests of Saturday. Before Trump was even sworn in, there was direct action in many cities, shutting down businesses like Uber in San Francisco. So any comments on that, either of you?
Well, you know, it's going to take many forms, like a healthy forest or a diverse garden. You have a lot of different activities. I think that it's not about individual expression, or shouldn't be nearly so much as group and collective activity that has a lot of diversity, but also develops a tactical and long-term strategic goal. And I think that's a twin responsibility or opportunity to push the envelope to be more fundamental in challenging the underlying ailments and the cause of this symptom of the Trump regime, and at the same time not be exclusive of drawing in other people. So let's get to the roots. Let's be suitably radical, but let's not fail to reach out to a broad cross-section of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis, a word on that, or
yes, the that's the real problem is for people to have the time and the space and the attention to figure out stuff to do that can work, you know, that will be sustainable, and that will keep building, and that will keep the sense of what we're up against alive. I mean, it's not as if this happened from the moon. It happened as an organic development in our society. And no matter how shocking or surprising or unlikely it seems, things got this way to where this could happen. And people are it's going to take a while for that to really sink in, it seems to me, and for people to realize that their lives have changed, and that they need to change what they think and what they do if they want to preserve any sense of what they thought they had that now seems so, so roughly snatched away from them.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And we're in, you could say, reaping a whirlwind of passivity, acceptance of authority, and internalization of the kinds of oppression that have lulled our daily life into so much acceptance of what is should be unacceptable. There was a wonderful sign I saw in Oakland that, like so many, had been written by hand. And I'm hoping I can remember it correctly. It was something like, I will not be accepting what I cannot change. I will change what I cannot accept. That was from Angela Davis. And we have been so brainwashed into believing that we can't change the fundamental inequities and destructiveness of the power structures of our society that it is a leap, because we have not been taught, trained, encouraged about how to organize, how to work together for fundamental social change. We've been taught how to be passive, and that's got to change.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
In Point Reyes Station on Inauguration Day, we had an alternative community event called Una Comunidad, Standing Together, sponsored by the Black Mountain Circle and West Marin Community Services. In the morning, there was a gathering at Cooley Loclo, meaning Bear Valley, a recreated Coast Miwok Native American village located a short walk from the visitor center of the Point Reyes National Seashore. There was a communal ceremonial fire started in the traditional way by hand with a fire drill, and it was a team effort to get it going. Then each person came up to the fire and said a prayer, offering sage and incense. This was followed by a 3-mile walk to the town of Point Reyes, where the Peace Garden was dedicated by the Rotary Club in front of Toby's Feed Barn. And in the evening, there was a community potluck feast featuring bilingual speakers bringing together the Latino community and the Anglo community, recognizing that we are all immigrants and the need to protect our vulnerable Latino brothers and sisters.
And, you know, that respect, that acknowledgement to not only Native American peoples, but also the mode of protest that we learned about, a lot of us learned about at Standing Rock. I think it's really important to bring that back because that story's kind of fallen out of the way. And before we get back to our guests, I just wanted to throw out some conversation I've heard in the last couple days about movement building. I think it was Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine who was saying, you know, there's a difference between coming out and expressing ourselves at demonstrations like we had Saturday and building power. And then within the question of building power, we need to be clear about the differences between political parties on the one hand, movements on the other. Movements are bottom up, political parties not necessarily so. And in building up bottom up power, it matters whose power is built and by whom. And finally, I'll add, this morning I heard one good example about the emerging leadership of women of color. And this is the It Takes Roots campaign of Grassroots Global Justice Alliance. They're putting out an intersectional analysis. That means they look at where race and class and gender and sexuality oppression intersect. And they're working in alliance with groups like the Indigenous Environmental Network. They call their work Growing the Resistance and are raising up the voices and leadership of women of color emerging from places like Standing Rock. And finally, they specifically say they are emphasizing solutions that are worker-based, co-op-based, and about renewable clean energy and, as she said, put forward by us. So they're really combining the social justice agenda around class, race, and gender, and I would say sexuality, with the environmental agenda about climate in a way that embodies that in not only the analysis but in the leadership, who's speaking and who's at the front of that. So now that Bing and I have had a few framing comments, we'd like to welcome Norman and Dennis back into that conversation. Where does that take you?
Well, on that note, I'd love to hear Dennis's comments. I'm remembering what he said a few minutes ago about activism, resistance, and hard work, all of it so crucial. And then the comments we just heard as well. It reminds me of an observation I heard last year, which is that working on a presidential campaign, or I would say for that matter, going to a large demonstration, is sort of like running off and joining the circus. And building a movement is like staying home and doing your chores. And we have a natural tendency to want to do the stuff that feels, if for lack of a better word, fun. But organizing, activism, resistance, the hard work required is a daily activity, and it is necessary to be a daily activity. And that means close to home then, sometimes causing some discomfort, because every society and every sector of the society, every what we call community, is based on injustice. It's fundamentally based on injustice. Now, there are a lot of other good there are a lot of qualities that are good, but it's based on injustice. And I hear frequently, and I've been living here in West Marin for about 20 years, I love living here, I hear so often about how it's an extraordinary, unique place. There's nowhere else like it on Earth. And I actually want to dissent from that. Of course, it's beautiful environmentally. There are many places around the planet that are beautiful environmentally. But I think we need to challenge ourselves around the conceit that somehow we're so unique, because it closes us off psychologically and perhaps emotionally from the fact that we, among other things, have the same kinds of injustices in different forms. And the class injustice is rife where we live. And that's what our society is based on, rapacious capitalism. And it's the same rapaciousness that's destroying the environment, that reinforces inequities at all different structures. So it's, you know, it's a tremendous challenge. I'm never complacent about it. I don't think anybody's sincerely complacent about it. We're not happy about this. But we've got to work to change it, and recognizing that is most of all effective, thinking globally and nationally, addressing globally and nationally, and doing the work where we live.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, and it's not necessarily clear what the work is. I mean, it's not necessarily clear what particulars people are going to be faced with in different localities, that they have to find ways to make their resistance effective, to stop wrong things. And it's not, you know, always or even mostly going to happen because people come into the streets to protest something that happened or something that was said or something that's being done. It has to go deeper than that, and it has to go farther than that, because, like you say, it's rapacious capitalism that we're up against, and it's only these, Trump and everybody else are just signs of it. I mean, he just put a bunch of rapacious capitalists in charge of the government, all the departments, and what they're going to be able to do and how they're going to be able to be stopped or slowed down or you know, changed in what they're intending is not at all clear. I mean, it's going to take a lot of hard thinking and people spending time together working things out and trying and failing and all that kind of stuff again, you say, well, it's because this is so new and this is so radical and extreme a threat, but what's underneath it, what's behind it, has been here all along. And like you say, Norman, people have found ways to, you know, in the end, cop out. Because all this stuff developed and it all happened and we're saddled with it all, and we were before this election. And we would have been if the election had gone the other way, you know, like the frog in the boiling water.
If you're just joining us, that is the voice of radical attorney Dennis Cunningham, who is joining us here on Post-Carbon Radio, along with Norman Solomon in the studio. And we're talking about, now that Trump is elected, where to go from here. There's been a lot of debate about how to respond. People are doing exactly what you're talking about, Dennis, getting together, having debates, having discussions, what should we do, and that's what this show is about. One of the questions that's coming up, I feel like it's been addressed somewhat, but I want to get a quick take from each of you. Are Trump voters the enemies of progressives? And if you think so, can that change? And if not, how do you see Trump voters?
Well, first, there's no doubt that Trump and his entire entourage are enemies of the well-being of humanity. Whether his voters are enemies depend on who we're talking about. And there's a wide gamut. But certainly those who appeal or respond favorably to appeals of racism, of the right-wing populism that blames people at the bottom rather than those at the top, those attitudes are enemy attitudes that we need to challenge. You know, stepping back, and I really, again, very much agree with what Dennis said, one of the stumbling blocks that understandably comes up is wrapped up in the question that often emerges, well, what should we do? What's the one thing we should do? And the answer is there's not one thing that we should do. That the healthy ecology of movements, it is trial and error. It's difficult. It's shifting. We have to keep analyzing and assessing. And at the same time, a healthy movement, even if it's very well focused, has many different facets. And so we can get stymied by saying, well, if there's a one or two things, first, I don't know what it is. Second, maybe it's a thing I don't want to do. And rather than go there, we should say there's something that everybody can do and that we have the skills, the talents, the interests, and the abilities to be involved with and to see the values of a lot. And just one other thought here. You know, I thought this morning of the metaphor that a lot of the work being done out of apparent necessity or need, the failure of government, the absence of government, the way that nonprofits jump to the sector, the boat is sinking for so many people. And so a lot of social services are engaged in bailing out the boat. Mm-hmm. But if all you're doing, or mainly what you're doing, is bailing out the boat, you're not fixing the boat. And the resources, such as they are from government and philanthropy, is for bailing out the boat, because it's not about fundamental change. And people who are in an awful boat, and arguably most people are in some way or other, simply bailing out the boat is not going to do it. We've got to fix and patch up and create a boat that is viable. And as always, or so often, when we go to the work of Martin Luther King, we can find tremendous transcendent wisdom. And he said that true compassion is not providing coins to the beggar. It's changing the system that creates beggars. And even if we don't see beggars around us, true compassion is not providing social services and relying on that. It is in addition to that, and most fundamentally, changing the system, challenging the power structure that creates this dire need for social services.
Yes. Yes. And recognizing that the power structure is what it is, you know, and that there's the fundamental divide between, it's almost like, I'm not a religious person, but it seems to me the great statement Jesus made was, you cannot serve God and mammon. And what we have is a system that's consecrated to mammon and to money as the ruling value, and to hierarchy and patriarchy and control and selfishness. And there has to be a recognition, it has to grow and deepen, that where that operates, things are not going to work out right, you know, and where that operates, where mammonismo is dominant, then people are going to be hurt in large numbers and deprived and denied, and their lives are going to be, you know, spoiled by this illegitimate power. And it's one thing to say that, though it's something else to understand what can be done about it.
Yeah, I think we all realize it's more than beyond Trump. It's stripped off the veneer, and I think a lot of people that I met are waking up and really want to get engaged. They feel it's time. And so, how should progressives respond to Trump voters, or should we?
Well, Trump voters, I mean, the economic smugness of the so-called liberal establishment has really paved the way. And when genuine progressive populism is blocked off by the elected officials, in this case of Democrats, and Democratic Party leadership, and I say that this is someone who is very supportive of Bernie Sanders. I'm not opposed to working within a party. But the reality is, when progressive populism is prevented by those in power, then the only avenue for the rage of people whose living standards are dropping is right-wing populism. So I think the way to create some of this informational change and attitudinal change includes being very, very clear what we're talking about. Wall Street is our enemy. Those who are ravaging the earth are our enemy. Those who propagate racism and misogyny and bigotry against people of various sexual orientations, that entire approach is fundamentally our enemy. We are not going to be willing to accept any attitudes from, if you will, Trump voters or others who say, well, let's make common cause around that sort of bigotry or tacit worship or explicit worship of the wealthy. We don't go with that. And at the same time, though, let's recognize that many people are in economic distress because of the structural inequities and dire injustices of the system. And if you want to talk about how to challenge that injustice, let's talk. Let's find ways if we can work together.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, you have anything you want to add to that?
Yes, and let's find, by trial and error or whatever it takes, let's find the real issues where we can make headway. I mean, for example, if you said, well, what should happen is the taxes on the rich should be doubled or tripled, and then there would be money to pay for all the things we need in the society. And that's thought of, and you're right, Norman. It's the liberal establishment which has brought us here over the years, those underlying attitudes have to be exposed and replaced.
So I think that's going to bring us to what we really want to get into, and we'll have to take a break in a minute, but we want to talk about the Democratic Party, this question of reforming the Democratic Party, and maybe we can start first, Norman, since you were a Bernie delegate. What should happen with Bernie's movement? Who's going to do it, and what's already happening? Has Bernie's movement been absorbed into the unreformed Democratic Party, or if not, how is it maintaining its independence? What are the Bernie-crats doing?
Well, let's reframe it. There was never a Bernie movement. I don't think Bernie would want it to be, seen as a Bernie movement. It was a people's movement that Bernie helped to catalyze and for a time was, in a leadership role. I think it's about, among other things, building structures. Online we have our revolution, which is a few million people who actively supported and contributed to Bernie. But we have many, many groups, whether it's Black Lives Matter, Presente, and others, various backgrounds and ethnicities, who are online and using the economies of scale of online because the barriers of entry are so much lower than buying a newspaper, that we can communicate. And I think that's tremendously exciting that we have ways to work together. One paradigm I've noticed, it's not a absolute direct correlation, but I'm generalizing. I think it's mostly the case. When progressives are willing to confront Democratic Party elected officials and others and office holders, the extent to which they're willing to denounce them is inversely proportional to their proximity. In other words, if it's somebody who's in the Senate and they're from far away and they are some powerful Democrat nationally, then the gloves come off and it's fine to directly verbalize challenge to them and so forth. But if it's a Democrat who's locally elected, who comes around from time to time, who's maybe it's a nonpartisan race, or they're in the Board of Supervisors, or they're in the State Assembly, or they're in the Congress, then there's a lot more reticence and hesitancy to say, you know what, this party is not serving people. It's serving the wealthy much more than serving people. And I think in a sense, and I think it was Abby Hoffman who said this 40 years ago, politeness came, and I'm not advocating for rudeness, but this over-politeness came from sort of the court of Louis XIV or something, where we're so acculturated to be deferential. And to be just very specific for a moment, I think it does go to this question of the Democratic Party. We got to do so much work outside of the electoral arena, and I think we also can do effective work inside the electoral arena. So here in Marin County, including West Marin, we have an assembly member named Mark Levine who has repeatedly voted against basic labor rights for farm workers. And it's almost never that I hear people talking about, how are we going to get this guy out of office? Mm-hmm. Well, why is that? He's a, quote, Democrat. He's supported by other Democrats. It's hard work. It's tedious. It's not a guarantee of success. So there's a tendency to just let it slide, pretend it isn't happening. Let me contrast that to a wonderful group, the Richmond Progressive Alliance in the city of Richmond.
Norman, I'm going to bust in on you. Yeah. Hold that thought. We'll get right back to it, but we have to take a quick break.
Great. Okay.
Right. Now back to Post Carbon Radio. And today's show, we're talking about after Inauguration Day, what's next? And our guests today are Norman Solomon and Dennis Cunningham.
And Norman, you were just about to contrast the sort of not challenging the Dems, especially when they're local, with the Richmond Progressive Alliance.
Yeah, so many issues are bound into what people have been doing in Richmond to organize effectively. Climate change, the power of multi-billion-dollar corporations, in this case Chevron, the environmental racism, the way in which the planet is being so damaged, and climate is such a awful specter over the future of the Earth and humanity and all living creatures. The power of landlords to afflict those who can't afford the rents, the power to evict, the lack of democracy, the way in which big money has historically disempowered people who have a right to democracy because of their race, because of their economic stature. Those issues and more have all been taken on, not only theoretically, but effectively by the organizers in Richmond for a decade and more. And one of the results, along with a tremendous amount of activism and understanding and education and galvanization of energies in Richmond, is victory. That the city council now is 5-2. Richmond Progressive Alliance members of the Richmond City Council, which has made possible changes in policy and will make changes in policy more feasible in the future. How has that happened? It's because people have used all of those different aspects of what's in the toolkit of activism and organizing and resistance, including electoral work, including not electoral work, but seeing the way that it can all dovetail effectively. And I really never tire of making this pitch that if people live in the East Bay, San Francisco, or Marin, there are ways to go to the website of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, get involved, be involved, because we not only can struggle and be engaged in resistance, we can win victories. And the Richmond Progressive Alliance has shown how it can be done in an urban area.
I want to talk about how we get that done in our own areas if we don't yet have a Richmond Progressive Alliance. And you were just a moment ago criticizing Mark Levine as a local Democrat who hasn't taken a stand for labor. And by contrast, Richmond Progressive makes working class issues a priority. I have to ask you, do you think those priorities are going to be, will they be priorities in an organization that's not led by working class people?
Well, it's a matter of who they are. It can be cross-class organizing as long as the principles are there. You know, nobody who is poor ended up cursing Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but he was a rich guy who was dragged into, and he wasn't adverse to being dragged into by people power from low-income working-class people. And the doors are open to people who really, really want to help, who really want to be engaged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's right. I think people, you know, everywhere, you can remember from the day after the election, and you see somebody you know and say, "How are you?" What do you mean, "How am I?" You know, that everybody, it's the shock that keeps on shocking, and you realize that you need to find examples where people have, you know, already figured out what it takes to get change to happen in a given place, like Richmond, as you describe it, and that's a marvelous thing. You know, it shouldn't necessarily be unique. It's not unique, but every place is unique, and they need their own way through those problems, and they have to get together and work on them and be willing to stay, to keep working rather than hurry home to watch Survivor.
So I want to let listeners know that at the end of the show, we're going to talk about just that. We're going to talk about upcoming events and opportunities for you to plug in if you're not already plugged in. So stay tuned and get your pencils ready. Meanwhile, Bing, I think we just got a new guest in the studio. You want to introduce her?
Yes. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Judy Spellman.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk about what we're doing to resist Trump's agenda here in West Marin. Let's see, I have my notes, but Judy is a retired nurse and a longtime health care for everyone single payer, right?
Yes.
And she helped me facilitate a meeting we had at my house last week. I put out an email telling people basically we're entering the gates of hell and we need to respond. So in response, I had something like over 30 people respond to my email, and I invited them to come to my house and Eleanor, my wife's house. And we had a gathering. And Judy, tell us what happened there.
Well, the first thing I want to say is thank you to Bing and to Eleanor for making the effort to pull the community together, offer their home, and to continue to take the initiative since we've had the meeting. The meeting, I think, is doing exactly what both Norman and Dennis are talking about. It is a local group trying to figure out what to do. And we came up with some very concrete ideas, which we think respond to what seem to be the immediate priorities, although we realize that our priorities, our activism, may have to change very quickly in response to what Trump decides are his priorities. But for starters, we created six committees. The first one is an organizing committee. Of course, you always have to have that to reach out to the broad West Marin community, to call meetings and set up agendas and form Excel spreadsheets like Bing did with all of our names and a mailing list, and to take a look at what's going on outside of our community, other local, state, and national activities, and see where we might want to coordinate with them and join them as opposed to what we might want to do locally on our own. The second committee that we formed, we're calling the Sanctuary Cities Committee. I think that I would say, wouldn't you agree, Bing, that almost everyone in that room agreed that standing with and for our Latino friends and neighbors and families is critical, and that we are going to protest any efforts to discriminate against them. In fact, there's a group of some of the people on that committee are attorneys, and they're looking into the possibility of creating West Marin as a sanctuary city or sanctuary community where our Latino community would be protected legally. The third committee was, I think, a bit of a surprise to some of us, but also very welcome. That's a writers and artists committee. And they, I think, want to infuse all of our efforts with the joy and beauty of art of all kind. And they have been asked now, some of us wrote a paragraph about what our mission will be, and we've now turned it over to them so they can write it with beauty and joy. Rewrite it with beauty and joy. The fourth committee we put together is a climate change environmental protection committee to watch over what Trump is doing, what he is making his priorities, to watch how some of the major pro-environmental groups are responding, and to decide when we want to work with them versus when we want to continue our own local efforts, environmental protection efforts, many of which are underway now. We formed a strategy/indivisible committee. Indivisible, you may know, is a very practical guide to grassroots resistance to Trump, put together by some former congressional staffers. And it focuses on many things, but in particular, it teaches people how to function within and organize within the U.S. Congress policy process, political process. And we formed a carpool committee, believe it or not, so that we could help all of us in West Marin get to demonstrations and other activities outside of the area without having to drive, all of us driving our own cars there. Our next meeting is scheduled for Saturday, January 28th at the church section of the Dance Palace. We anticipate having far more than the 34 people who showed up to the first meeting. We will have updates from the committees, and we'll discuss next steps. Now, Bing, I was thinking we would give out my email address and your email address in case anybody wished to talk to us or make contact with us before the meeting. Or if anyone wants to join one of the working committees, we can put you in touch with the people who are doing that work. Is that okay with you?
Yes. My email is binggong, B-I-N-G-G-O-N-G, at sonic.net.
And mine is Judy Spellman at att.net, and there is one L in my last name, Judy Spellman at att.net.
And Judy, you just announced that meeting, and that'll be at 3 p.m., right?
Oh, thank you. Yes, that'll be at 3 p.m.
I was really heartened by our meeting. So many people had been active in the past, either in the 60s or 70s or against the Iraqi war, and this woke them up, and they were wanted to be engaged again, to get active again. They realized the importance.
You know, I think that I had the same feeling not only about our committee, but about looking at the demonstrations over the weekend across the country and across the world. I had the feeling that this is not going to be a one-time event in people's lives. I think it's initiating and reactivating, initiating activism in some people and reactivating it in others. I expect to see some consistent, very smart activism, you know, to preserve the values that we care about, to preserve democracy, to preserve immigrant rights and the environment and health care for all, among other things.
And this is Karin. I'm going to throw in there in the conversation because I was really struck by what you said about your writers and artists committee and that you want to use beauty and joy. I play with a band called the Hubbub Club, and we played the Saturday March in Santa Rosa to just one of the most fantastic crowds we've ever played to, which is saying something. And we were so motivated that we stayed an extra hour. But I think that, to me, is one of the most encouraging things, is that not only are people coming out, but they're not coming out with this, like, dire, negative thing. People are coming out because I think we've all felt so sort of depressed and oppressed in different ways for so long, and we're losing, that to have everyone come out, I think we mutually hearten each other. And this reaching for joy is, exactly, is going to have a different impact. It gives a different feeling from the start to this movement. I'm interested in our guest comments on that.
Well, I want to first say that I was at that Santa Rosa demonstration, and I heard you playing, and you all were, you were uplifting and fun, and it was a joy-filled demonstration, as the others around the world and around the country seem to be.
Yes, very much.
We're hungry for it.
It's so wonderful. So wonderful energy in Oakland, and just then, for me, being there, and then seeing video and hearing and seeing photographs, it's wonderful. I immediately thought of something that Emma Goldman said, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution, still applies. And also the wonderful song, was it in the textile factories in Massachusetts? The Bread and Roses song came out of women in that labor battle, saying we fight for bread and roses.
Yeah.
I'd also note that it meant a lot to me that this march was a women's march, because I feel like feminism over the last 10 or 20 years has almost become a dirty word. We've had a lot of politics around race and racism, and of course we absolutely need that. We need to discuss everything. But gender has sort of, I think, been under-treated for a while. And so to have that brought back up on the agenda in such a big way, I thought was important. Dennis, I want to bring you back in because you haven't had a comment for a while. Mm-hmm. Do you want to weigh in on any of the comments so far?
Well, I'm sitting here listening, and I think of, you know, my own stuff, which is about cops, and I think about what I was thinking the most during the election, and about what was going to happen, which is about the wars, and which we haven't talked about either of those things, and there's no blame, but those powers, locally the cops, internationally, the wars, the militarism, the military budget, the depth to which all the support for it is organized, and the length to which it's proven that the Mammonites can go, in spite of everyone being against it, they still do it. And so the level of the problems that are beyond our local, you know, compass is almost, and particularly when you realize with all the provocations against the Russian and against China now, and you know that among these lunatics that are installed are some who believe in nuclear war and want to strike the enemy with the ultimate weapons and are that crazy and yet in control of important things and dangerous things. And so I guess my point is that all the people that come together and they know what committees to form and stuff like that because they know what they can come to grips with and start working on. But there's this further lurking problem that's so big and so, you know, dangerous and so intractable that there has to be a place for consideration of it and for keeping up with what's happening with it, even if people don't have a good sense of anything they can immediately start doing about it. They still have to, you know, find the ways, ultimately, to slow down that militaristic machine locally, nationally, internationally.
Dennis, Judy's got a question for you.
Now, if you've already discussed this and I miss it, we just drop it. But I'm wondering what you think the role of your profession, the legal profession, might be in protecting our values and our and the laws that we care about in the coming 4 years.
Well, they just had the lawyers have to get involved. The young lawyers have to turn aside from their Mammonite pursuits or their Mammonite impulses. Or the idea of cleaving to power and getting to the top and getting rich. And they have to let themselves be inspired, as many of us were, you know, 40 years ago, to get in and help, you know, not to try to tell everybody what to do, but try to help them evade certain kinds of threats and defend against other kinds of threats and delegitimize a legal system that works top down and screws the masses and you know, stay with it.
Norman, I see you ready to comment.
Yes. Well, Dennis's discussion of war and militarism, I think, gets us to such a crucial aspect of what we're dealing with. Martin Luther King said that the bombs in Vietnam exploded home, and he meant so many dynamics that are still with us today. Of course, the economic deprivation tied in with squandering money on killing people, but also the PTSD, the suffering, the ways in which violence has been normalized and internalized, the way in which so much of the weaponry of war is now being provided to police forces based on class and racial bias and violence meted out against poor people and people of color. And while it doesn't solve anything per se to understand where we've been in recent years, I think it's helpful. As somebody who's been engaged in anti-war work, it was very noticeable to me that during the George W. Bush administration, when the drones were flying and killing people, when the U.S. bombers were flying and killing people, there was among many self-described liberals and progressives, people on the left, outrage, as there should have been. When Barack Obama for 8 years had an administration when the drones were flying, when the bombers were bombing. As a matter of fact, Obama's rate of dropping bombs in the world was a little bit more than George W. Bush's. And yet it was very, very difficult to get any sort of response from people who were outraged when Bush was doing it to be outraged when Obama was doing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm sorry to say as well that in the last year, there were many who were absolutely outraged at George W. Bush's war enthusiasm, were very strongly for Hillary Clinton during the primaries when Hillary Clinton is in policy, as many leading neocons have said, a neocon, a proponent of regime change, supported not only the invasion of Iraq, but the intervention in Libya, wanted U.S. Military escalation in Syria under the euphemism of no-fly zone. And, you know, it's on a class basis, was a me-first sort of feminism, where feminism was redefined as something to help affluent women, and poor women were being shafted by the exact capitalism and Wall Street enthusiasm that Hillary Clinton was the leading exponent of. And so I think it's a challenge today, and I'll just be very brief on this. Dennis referred to the, I'll use the word warmongering, about Russia. And when you look at the polling, you find that a year ago, 8 months ago, Democrats had a much more conciliatory and favorable view of Vladimir Putin than Republicans. It has totally flipped. And so the essentially war escalation or military escalation affect of Democratic Party national leadership has caused so many people who identify as Democrats to be led towards enthusiasm for a new Cold War. And that ought to be a cautionary note to us in terms of the kind of work we have to do going forward.
I'd like to give Dennis, you have any final words before we wrap up?
I'll park with that. I mean, I think that's, you know, in the world, it's the number one issue. And Michael Clark pointed out, you know, there could be a flashpoint in the Baltic because of Uncle Sam moving his troops up to Russia's border. There could be a flashpoint in Ukraine. There could be a flashpoint in the South China Sea. We could be at war in a week, you know. I mean, I guess with Hillary defeated, we won't be at war with Russia in the next 6 months, but it doesn't really matter who we go to war with as long as the whole point is to get out there and slaughter people and beat your chest because America is so great again.
Well, with that, I think we're going to have to wrap up with the promised announcements of some upcoming events, and we will thank our guests on the way out. So, Bing, tell us what's going on.
Yeah, on Saturday, January 28th at 3 p.m., our next meeting of our local Resist Trump agenda in West Marin will be at the Dance Palace in the church space. That's Saturday, January 28th at 3 p.m.
And we had two emails for that. That was Judy Spellman with one L at att.net and Bing Gong at sonic.net, right? The next day, for those of you in Sonoma County, Sunday, January 29th, from noon to 5, there's a first-time-ever event. It's called the Community Engagement Fair. It's going to be at the Sonoma County Fairgrounds in Garrett Hall, and it's free and open to the public. This is a big tabling opportunity. There will be 70 groups or something tabling. And an opportunity for you to meet those groups who are working for change in Sonoma County and pick one that works for you and plug in. So, again, that's Sunday the 29th, noon to 5, Sonoma County Fairgrounds. And in Petaluma on January 31st at 6:30, there's going to be a similar event called Where Do We Go From Here? And that's going to be a combination of plug-in festival and conversation at the Aquus Cafe on 189 H Street in Petaluma. That's at 6:30 on Tuesday the 31st. And
on April 29th, 350.org is having a People's Climate March in Washington, D.C. I don't know if there'll be a regional Bay Area march or not, but Eleanor and I are planning to be in D.C. for that event.
And I just found out in Sonoma County that the May Day has been redefined in Sonoma County this year. It's going to be on April 29th because we're going to have our May Day march on the same day to coincide with the climate march in D.C. So, yeah.
Thank you for listening to Post Carbon Radio. I'd like to thank Norman Solomon, Dennis Cunningham, and Judy Spellman for being our guests today.
And thanks, everybody.
All right. Stay tuned for Cruisin' with Rick Clark.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce.